T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Sports Radio 716 on Saturday night. Sweeney and Murdy here until 11 o'clock, and we'll get to your phone calls a little bit later, 877-337-6666. The update on Masahiro Tanaka, he had concussion-like symptoms, but they have dissipated. He is expected to be released from the hospital tonight. So that is, CT scan was negative, so at least some good news to start, and obviously they'll monitor him very closely after taking the line drive off his head off the bat of Giancarlo Stanton during today's simulated game at Yankee Stadium. Aaron Boone also informed the media that Luis Sessa and DJ LeMahieu both tested positive for COVID-19. They're quarantining out of state, so they tested positive wherever at their homes before arriving here. So they're entering that protocol, and we'll get further information on that as they get going. So with only 3 weeks to go, that's not a great sign here as far as getting them ready. But we'll see if they are symptom-free at least. Maybe they can get through this protocol and be ready to join the season that starts in just under 3 weeks now. July 4th. I mentioned earlier, it always brings up memories at Yankee Stadium. First of all, happy birthday, John Sterling, and happy birthday to the late George Steinbrenner. It was always a special day on July 4th, and this guy made it more so on July 4th, 1983. Former Yankee and fan favorite, I want to welcome in Dave Righetti. Dave, it's Sweeney Murdy here in New York. How you doing?
Sweeney, good, man. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. I know we haven't actually had a chance to meet, cross paths in different ways, but thank you for taking a couple of minutes here. And want to bring in the guy that was 60 feet 6 inches away from you all day on a 94-degree day in 1983. Your catcher, Butch Weiniger, kind enough to join us on the phone here as well. Butch, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Sweeney. Ragsy, how you doing? It's been a little while.
What's up, Butch?
Hey, what's up, kid?
You still coaching?
I just finished up my last year. I think I'm going to go into semi-retirement, or I'm going to just take a year off and let this body rest a little bit. I picked a good time.
I hear you. Of course, they're retiring all of us anyway. They don't want us around, so.
They don't. The experience means nothing anymore.
You're a special advisor now, right, Dave?
Yeah, very special, Sweeney. you know what, they honestly, it would have been nice, a different year for me. They were... I was going to be an advisor to our minor league coordinators, and I was looking forward to that, actually, and because sitting around waiting to go to the big league ballpark and being around there was a waste of time, to be honest. You were better off, and I was better off in the lower minors, or being around those kids more. And so anyway, I was looking forward to that. Unfortunately, we canceled everything, so...
Yeah, I feel bad for the kids who are losing a lot of development time.
Oh, man.
You guys are instrumental in that. I mean, this is not easy to lose a full calendar year of real game action, no matter how much you can simulate. But you were in the minor leagues, I mean, for a long time here. Taking away a full year's worth of minor league at-bats for somebody right now, that's got to be really painful.
That's what I've been saying all along. I think as much as these kids work and as much time and effort that they put in, to have a full year off. I mean, I remember what it was like just to go on the DL for 6 weeks and come back, and how tough that was. So to lose a full year like this, I think it's going to really be detrimental. It's going to hurt a lot of kids.
Hey, Sweeney, you know what happens? I know it happened to me. Mm-hmm. When you sign up, when you first sign, most managers and coordinators leave the guy alone for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But they can't wait to start working with a guy, you know. They see, because you're not a perfect, you know, player. So there's always talk. What should we do with this guy and that guy? Eventually, they get around to doing it, and that player's got to adjust to that. And not all the time it doesn't work. And so there's always there's a long period sometimes in the minor leagues for guys to, to what do you call it? Take chances on a windup or a batting stance or what have you. And it doesn't work out. And man, to lose a year of that, and because when you're 24 or 5 and you're a bubble guy, they're just releasing these guys left and right.
Right. Right, and I think the trickle-down probably won't be felt for a couple of years fully because
the guys
who are in A-ball and maybe should be in the major leagues in 3 years are going to lose a lot of valuable time and might not be ready at that time. I think that's really going to be felt. Listen, I'm going to try to walk you guys through this, and I'll try to point the questions right at each one of you, but if you feel you have something you want to jump in, don't wait for me, okay? I want to hear you guys talk about this. This is wonderful. I mentioned that every July 4th when the Yankees are home, this is one of the highlights that comes up on the scoreboard, and they always show the highlights of this no-hitter. I want to know, Dave, listen, I don't know the date of everybody has thrown a no-hitter, but I know the date you threw a no-hitter because it was July 4th and because it was the Yankees. Does there seem to be something special for you and maybe for the people in your life who keep reminding you every July 4th about that date?
I'm without a doubt, a week doesn't go by without somebody mentioning it. And, and anybody that played with me, most of the guys make fun of me the way after the third strike, the way I jumped. Fell into Butch's arms, but Willie Randolph and those guys love to make fun of me. But you know what? I did. I got lucky. I picked the perfect day. My mom's birthday was 2 days later, which was the All-Star game date in Chicago that year. So it was a nice present for her. And, of course, I didn't know it was George's birthday. But, you know, it was an odd day, and Butch will tell you this. We know it was hot, but The Yankees never did anything on the field, and that day was strange because Phil Rizzuto had to sit in the stands and Frank Messer, and they were doing giveaways and stuff, which they never did in Yankee Stadium. So that part was odd. You know, they had Chuck Mangione sitting down there in the first row with Rizzuto. I said, "The heck's going on down here today?" But anyway, it was July 4th, and that was the last thing I thought was going to happen. I thought I was going to get tired, to be quite honest, and I was hoping to go 7 full innings, and then, you know, they'd probably call on Goose, but honestly, I was very fortunate. The rest of my life, I've gotten newspaper articles from all over the world and for people to sign things and everything, and I just picked the right day.
Butch, what do you remember about the warm-up that day? I mean, Dave, it was 94 degrees at game time. We all know that it was a hot day and July 4th. Do you remember anything specific about the warm-up for you guys that day?
Not so much the warm-up and everything. I just, being Raggy's catcher and everything, I was concerned with the 94-degree heat. Maybe I was concerned more about myself. I don't know how hot it was going to be back there.
Yeah.
But, it was pretty obvious from the get-go that Raggy had something special going on. It never really entered my mind until middle of the game or something like that, because I was always aware of the scoreboard. But and I don't think Raggy and I talked very much during the game because everything was going pretty well. But when he struck out 7 of the first 9 guys that came to the plate and everything, I said, wow, this could be a special day for Raggy. Mm-hmm. My only concern was with the heat and keeping Raggy's pitches down as much as we could, his number of pitches. And for me, a turning point in that game really was the fourth inning when Raggy only threw 5 pitches, which really got you back in the line for the number, for your number of pitches and everything. And then it was kind of smooth sailing after that. But Stevie Palermo was the home plate umpire, and I think Stevie was one of the best in the league, and I loved him back there. We talked the whole game. And I thought I could have punched him in the ninth inning when he asked me, why didn't you tell me, Greg, you had a no-hitter going? He turned to me and said that because the stadium was going crazy. And I said, come on, Stevie, you knew he had a no-hitter going. He goes, I swear, Butch, I didn't know. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, you son of a gun, you just jinxed Greg. So,
because that 1-2 pitch, that 1-2 pitch, he could have rang him up, but
he
didn't do it. He told me I had to earn it. I said, what? What do you mean earn it? Threw 150 pitches out here, and I don't know how hot it was. Facing that lineup, I said, you know what? I'd rather put you remember when Palermo in the eighth inning, he ran back to the backstop.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he ever told you, because I never asked him, but did he break his leg or tear up his knee? I know he definitely got hurt
because he
was laying on the ground.
I saw that story. He was chasing after it when there was a foul pop, and he ran after the catcher. He did tear up his knee, and it was actually something he needed surgery for, and he would miss significant time. But he stayed in to finish that game, even with that. And
right.
I mean, I think we all – I mean, the late Steve Palermo, I think we all gained a lot of respect for him after what happened in that All-Star break incident in 1991.
Yeah.
And I would see him around the ballpark after that, especially in Kansas City when he'd come out and evaluate umpires. Mm-hmm. He was fun to talk to. But boy, I mean, you talk about what you guys had to go through in that heat. You know, it sounds like you had a lot of respect for what he had to do in that situation too.
Go ahead, Butch.
I was going to say, what I admired about Stevie is how, number one, how much into the game he always was.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch the video and you watch it close, you see him behind me and behind Jeff Newman doing a lot of clapping during the game. I mean, it's like, okay, you know, clap. And I don't know if he was trying to get people moving or if
Sunday.
He was into the game and having a good time. But he was very, very energetic, always on the move. I mean, that's why he was so skinny.
He used to throw knuckleballs back to you, Sweeney.
Did he really?
I said, do I need to catch a knuckleball from you? Just give me your damn ball back, will you?
Hey,
I got a funny story.
Yeah.
So when that happened, Pinella was the hitter, and he already had a frustrated day because he had a couple balls way out the left center, and
there
had been home runs anywhere else, and he was ticked off. But when he went down, he was standing there. Nettles was sitting next to me. And he says, hey, you know what the great part is? I said, what? He goes, nobody's called him out yet. But he goes, when Palermo calls him out, what is Lou going to do? You know? But fortunately, Lou said because he knew the no-hitter was going and it was already a delay, he didn't want to make it even worse for me to sit on the bench any longer. But anyway, Newman did catch the ball and came up with a handful of with a popcorn box stuck to his hand.
Right.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dave Righetti and Butch Weiniger, the battery that combined for the no-hitter on July 4th, 1983, Yankee Stadium. Sweeney Murdy on the Fan here till 11 o'clock. The first inning when you struck out the side, and as Butch said, 7 strikeouts over the first 3 innings. Did that tell you something about what you had that day, Dave? Was there something specific you were doing that helped you get through not just there but set up maybe the next couple of turns through the order?
Well, you know, they beat our rear ends for 2 days on Friday and Saturday, and I was just trying to get us off to a good start. And it's funny, the next year when they made me a closer, Steinbrenner related that to me. He goes, you know, you're always good in the first 3 innings. You know? I said, well, you want me to be bad in the first 3 innings? I said, so they turned it, you know, they used that against me when they made me a closer, but when I went back to look at that, and my ball, I had a moving fastball, but mm-hmm. I did. I pumped it in there a lot. I did pitch an awful lot like a closer, and until we got in the middle of the game when Butch started calling those change-ups and a little bit of curveballs and moving. Yeah, that was much better. I enjoyed pitching like that, to be honest, but I had a lot of pressure on me, believe it or not, over my first 2 years because – everybody fought over how I should pitch. Should I go right at everybody and use my fastball, or should I mix it in? So I really had a lot going on there with finding myself as a pitcher. And Art Fowler was the pitching coach that year, and Art wasn't real technical. But he just handed me the ball, and he goes, go do what you feel is right. And I just, you know what I ended up doing? I ended up following Butch and Cerrone, who – you know, were my two catchers and had known me for at least 2-3 years each. And I just trusted those guys and went out and pitched.
Hey, Butch, the start before that, Dave, you threw your first complete game shutout 5 days before that against the Orioles. Butch, did you know that there was something kind of different happening between the start 5 days before that and now that he strikes out the side in the first inning? Could you tell there was something different happening here that he had maybe found that groove the pitcher searched for?
I think so. I mean, like Raggy said, his fastball was probably his best pitch, especially that day there. But I always thought that Raggy was a pitcher, not just a thrower. And then he conveyed the story about him going to closing and becoming more of a thrower, come in and throw as hard as you can, as long as you can.
Yeah.
But I loved Raggy's curveball. I loved Raggy's changeup. Yep. And I knew that if we could get him to the point where he was using that more often, it was going to make his slider and his fastball so much better. And it was obvious, and that started on July 4th, that Rags's fastball had good movement. It had good ride on it. And I noticed in the video when I watched it quite a few times how many times I called for fastball up in the zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew you had a lot of ride and everything on it. But I said over the years that what was special for July 4th for me was your ability to throw the curveball for a strike and to throw your changeup for a strike. And I think that really slowed down Rice and Boggs and Armas because they were just stuck in the middle somewhere and they didn't understand what was going to happen to them, what you were going to throw. So that was what made that day so special for me. It was like I could almost call anything and you were going to deliver with it. So that's when I started seeing you start evolving into a pitcher as opposed to a thrower.
I agree.
Yeah, that was fun.
Until the eighth and ninth inning when I was gassed and I tried to throw everything as hard as I could. Because those were really – the ninth inning was actually the worst I'd thrown in terms of trying to command the zone. I got a little excited probably.
You only threw five pitches in the eighth inning too. You know that.
Well, yeah, you know what? The best thing that ever happened – and this one, when Evans hit that ball and Kemp jumped in the stands down the right field line, I said, oh, geez, I might have a shot. And then Stapleton pop up. You know, in that ballpark, Sweeney, as you know, especially the old one, I'm not sure how much the new one, how much room there is, but there was no room down the lines and not much foul ground. So when you got pop-ups caught and fly balls get caught in the stands like that, you know, you go, well, maybe it is my day, so let's take advantage of this thing. But, yeah, those felt good to get those really quick because most of those at-bats took a long time.
So there were a few walks earlier in the game, but when were you actually aware, Dave, of the no-hitter? Were you one of these guys that always knew, hey, you hadn't given up a hit, or was there a certain point in the game where you kind of look up and say, huh, I guess this is happening?
I always knew, Sweeney.
Yeah.
Anybody, I don't know. Not only that, I had a bunch of close calls in the minor leagues. I had three or four one hitters, and you know what? You're aware. You know if you not only that, you know if you've been in the stretch or not. Because as a pitcher, the biggest thing I got caught in a game. I'll never forget it. Sorry to ramble, but we were in Charleston, and I struck out I think 10 out of the first 12 guys. And I remember Sammy Ellis was the pitching coach, and I got in a stretch for the first time in the fifth inning. I think after an out, and I think I walked three, four guys. I don't even know if I pitched the next inning. And I said, that'll never happen again. And I always would make sure that I threw a couple pitches out of the stretch, in between innings. And so anyway, you know, I didn't think about a perfect game ever. I always walked somebody. So, but, yeah, you know, just a long story to get around to telling you. Yeah, you damn right you know.
Was there anything you guys considered, besides Kemp's play in the eighth, was there anything else that you guys considered, because that was a foul ball, close to a hit? I know Winfield had to track some balls down deep. Was there anything else that you thought was a close play?
I think, go ahead, Mitch.
No, I was just going to say, I think Boggsy ended up hitting, I think Boggsy had some terrible swings that day off of you and everything, but he did manage to hit two balls to center field.
Two hangers.
Well. Yeah, I think Reed Nichols hit a decent ball to center field, but really, watching the video and everything, I didn't really see anything that came close to a hit.
Yeah, I think Campy made a nice play on an infield topper by Armas, Tony Armas,
right.
I think.
Yep,
right.
And I think Smalley went in the outfield, big speedy
pop-up,
Roy, and he ran a ball down. But, Boggs always complains, oh, why was Winfield, if there was somebody else playing center, he would have never been standing there. I said, yeah, right. But Winning didn't catch it on the run. It was like a loping. But as soon as he hit it, they're out, no matter how hard they hit him. But he hit both of those well. And that it reminded me, I didn't shake Butch off in the ninth. I don't think I shook him off much at all. But I hung two sliders to him. He was the only one I hung a slider to because he tried to throw it too hard. And in the ninth inning, if you see, I got my arm up better, and the two sliders I threw him really broke down in the dirt. Mm. But early in the game, I think I hung them both because my arm was a little flat, to be honest.
Right.
We're talking to Dave Righetti and Butch Weiniger, talking about the July 4th, 1983 no-hitter, part of Yankee lore. It was actually the first no-hitter that a Yankee had thrown since Don Larsen's perfect game in 1956. Yeah. Did you, Dave, know that it had been that long?
No, I had no idea, but I knew Larsen's perfect game, of course, and during the old-timers games, Allie Reynolds would come in, and he'd remind me, I got two old. And he, but no, you don't. I'm just honest to God, Sweeney. I'm thinking two bad starts. I may be going to Columbus. And so
that was a constant back then, wasn't it? For everybody who was on that team.
You know what? Especially for guys that didn't have either the contract yet or enough time. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, and that's no joke. You were gonna. If he felt like it, you were going. And you know what? I guess you think about those things. I'm just trying to beat the Red Sox and us to win and go on to, you know, the All-Star break. You know, back then, Butch started catching me more than I remember that because I think it was Yogi that used to put it in my ear that, cause, you know, of course, he's paying attention to the catchers, but he thought that Butch was more likely to call my changeup and curveball more because I wasn't a shake-off. I didn't shake off much, and I really trusted these guys. And so I think I know Yogi really liked the combination that at that time because Butch would call that more. But Cerrone was very aggressive, and, you know, so either way it was fine with me. But, you know, I just remember that a little bit.
I want to ask you guys about the ninth inning. I'll go through it a little bit. But before I get there, I want to talk to you about heading out for the ninth inning. David Cohn, in the wonderful book he wrote last year with Jack Curry, mentions, you know, he had come so close so many times to throwing a no-hitter. He's got eight perfect innings in the books. And before he goes out for the ninth, he's staring at himself in the bathroom mirror and daring himself to go out there and do this and telling himself that this is his chance. Don't mess it up. Basically kind of figuring out how to pump himself up to go out there. Did you have any kind of a moment before that ninth inning as you walked
out
to that mound?
I'm laughing, sorry. Yeah. Well, you can go in our bathroom and look in the mirror, but it was cracked. Because Nettles was around. I mean, Pinella was around most of the time. So, I'm sorry, Lou, but there was a good chance that mirror was cracked. But, you know what I did? And it had nothing to do with Butch. That year I decided, and I got into a ritual. I would put my glove and stuff down next to Art Fowler, and I think Guidry was always sitting there, and Billy. And I would go in the clubhouse to get away from anybody, to be honest, because the year before I got crushed by – we had three different pitching coaches that year, and everybody – you know, I said, you know what? I am – and it had nothing to do – I love these people, but – and Butch is the one guy I should have sat next to, but or Cerrone. But I would go in the clubhouse and go get a piece of gum, kill an inning. I'd wait till two outs, then I'd come back in the dugout. And, you know, I did that just to get away. But the last inning, I walked up there, like, you know, and I sit in my locker for an out, I'd throw the gum. I go in our food room back there. Problem was the TV was on. And, of course, everybody was downstairs or wherever they were going to be. They weren't going to move. But Nettles was standing in the clubhouse. Because he hadn't gone out there while we were hitting. And to make a long story short, he's asking me, because we were going somewhere on the All-Star break, me and him, because we weren't going to go home. And he goes, you want me to drive or what? You know, I think it was just to relax me. And I said, yeah, you drive, you know, or whatever. And then I heard Fran Healy, because the TV was on, say something about the no-hitter. And I went, you know, just don't let... I don't want him to feel bad, so let's go out and do this thing. But, again, I didn't look in the mirror, I guess.
Butch, you were quoted as saying you could tell he was jumpy, but you didn't want to break the rhythm because you hadn't talked to him much during the game and you just didn't want to do anything different. Could you tell there was something different about him heading out for the ninth?
Yeah, well, I could tell. Yeah. And right, you said it earlier. You know, he was excited. He was overthrown a little bit. There was a lot of pitches up and out of the zone and everything.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to go to the mound. I didn't really want to go out there just knowing Ragsy and I knew he was fine. I more or less tried to slow the game down just by talking to Stevie a little bit, maybe not getting set as early, just to try to slow Ragsy down a little bit and everything. And it was something that dawned on me not too long ago. I knew who was coming up. I knew 8, 9, and 1 were coming up.
Yeah.
And Boggs and Rice were 4 and 5. And I took some heat over the years when people heard me say this. But in my heart, it was so true. I really wanted to get the win. That was my number one priority. Number two was the shutout, and number three was the no-hitter. And I had a lot of people say, Butch, you're full of crap. You wanted the no-hitter. I said, sure, I did. But anyway, my goal was, I said, man, if we can go 3 up, 3 down here, it'd be wonderful. Don't have to face Boggs. Don't have to face Rice. Do you remember that when you walked Jeff Newman to start the ninth off? It was a good battle, seven pitches back, and he finally walked. And then the ground ball to shortstop by Hoffman. And Andre Robinson made a wild throw to first base that pulled Donnie off the bag. And so now we got runner on first and one out, and I'm going, son of a gun. Boggs is going to freaking come up here somehow. and now we get the ground ball to second, and Andre throws the first for the force. Now I'm going,
nice
son of a
quick.
Gun. We got Boggs up with a runner on second. I'm going to lose. I don't want to lose this shutout. But I remember Roy Smalley telling me after the game, he goes, Butch, when I saw you put down slider 2-2, I knew we got him. I said, well, thanks, Roy. I'm glad you did.
Cause yeah.
But that's still one of the things. If I sit back and really think about it, I can still feel that ball hitting my glove.
Yeah.
When he swung and missed. And the reaction, you don't see me get excited too often and everything. I tried to stay, but me jumping in the air and coming out. And Ragsy, I saw the ton of bricks just fall off your shoulders.
Yeah.
On that pitch. And that's when you slumped and everything. And I was holding you up more than anything.
Yeah, you're right.
That was wonderful.
You're right. Yeah, wonderful. I was worried about Boggs because I was going to throw the slider, and you know the way I peeled off towards third base. I thought he'd hit a ball between me and first base.
And you couldn't
and
get to it.
So after Remy hit the ball over to second, I made a move on that pitch, on the fastball, and I said I might need that on the next guy. So if you look, I do a couple knee bends. Why did you do that? Yeah. Were you nervous? I said, well, I was coarse, but I did that to make sure my legs were ready because I know damn well I'm going to have to cover first. And I got that in.
Dave,
it might have been the best slider you threw all day right there.
Yeah. I think because I was tired.
Dave, Boggs said you threw two different kinds of sliders. He said one that breaks and one that doesn't. He said, I guessed wrong. How did you approach those two, you know, that pitch two different ways and when you would use them?
Well, when I was younger, I pitched on the first base side of the rubber, so all my best fastballs were just off the plate running away. And my left-handers, I was knocking them down constantly, and my breaking ball was flatter because I'd started at them more, and I had almost like a high cut, like a lot of the guys throw today. And then the right-handers, I definitely didn't want to throw the slider down towards the middle of the plate. I wasn't on top like Dibry. Mine was a little bit more three-quarter, low three. So I like to backdoor mine, have it go real late. And then when I threw it in, I just looked up and down the body, to be honest. Stay out of the middle of the zone because when it was in the middle, it didn't have that downward break like Guidry's would have. And honestly, like Butch said, the last two were actually the best I threw all day. They actually got down in the dirt and got the swings. But
Dave, you're breaking up on me a little bit. I hope just a couple of more minutes with you. I hope this line holds up. So I wanted to ask you both, though. Listen, Wade Boggs, we know, is a Hall of Famer, 3,000 hits. He was only in his second year, and he hadn't racked up a lot of batting titles. But he's coming into this game. He's hitting .361. He's hitting almost .400 over the last 2 weeks. And you already know that he doesn't strike out a lot. You had already struck him out one time in this game. How hard was it? I mean, just forget about the fact that that's not the guy you wanted to face for the last out, but you've already struck him out one time. You've thrown 130 pitches already. Were you trying to wonder like what you had to do to get this guy out after all of this?
Well, either line drive the center or, but you know what? I faced him coming up through the minor league. I did well. And even in that at bat, almost every at bat, I made sure I threw a fastball up and in near his chin area. And he had a foul ball half swing on one of the pitches.
Yeah.
I definitely threw him a pitch up there, and I always did that. I just wanted to buy a little room away. I know he's not a pull hitter. He's not going to try to pull me. Mm-hmm. And he's going to wear out the five, in between short and third on me.
Hey, oh. Butch, had you ever caught any other no-hitters, or was this the only one?
He's not going to miss it.
I remember one was with the Twins down in Texas with Steve Luber. Two outs, two strikes before Mark. I think Mike Hargrove looped a single into left field. So that was the closest I came. I had a couple one hitters, but nothing compared to Ragsy's.
Hey, Dave, Butch answered this one already as he was talking about it, but I always love to ask you guys this one question. Because you're years removed from the achievement. Like Butch said it, he can feel that ball hitting that 2-2 slider to Boggs hitting his glove. Can you feel yourself throwing that pitch? Do you remember what it feels like as you close your eyes?
Yeah. There's things I know now. Coaching for kids and trying to help some of my guys. What I was doing. Rearing back like that and overthrowing and flying open and things like that. I fought that my whole career. But, yeah, you definitely feel it. And exactly how a little force of your hand, like the two, if you look back to 1-2 fastball that we got him with, actually helped me, or he didn't call strike three, but it came back on the outside corner. That actually helped me on my slider because I threw it out of the same slot. The very next pitch, but say I just winged one up and in, and like you said, do you feel that? Well, that's what I'm feeling. You're reading your pitches just like a golfer will read a swing, or you read swings of the hitters. You're reading your pitches. Why not just do that? And how can I just get back this thing back in line? And so by that time, I was starting to learn myself better. But you feel that. You walk yourself through it all the time. I was just grateful it happened because. If it didn't, and the very next year I went to become a closer and never got a chance to start again, I would have thought about that the rest of my life if I gave up a hit there, but I wouldn't have felt bad about it. As long as we won, I'd have been happy.
Dave, were you on board with the move to closer the next year? I mean, you made two All-Star teams, and you had a pretty good career, and until Mariano Rivera came along, you could have made a case that you were the best closer in Yankees history, but were you hoping that you could... I mean, I guess it wasn't as prestigious a role at that particular point in time yet. Were you fighting that move?
It was in New York because of Goose.
Okay,
because
right.
Of Sparky.
Right. Yes.
And because George, they made such a big deal. I mean, Yogi's the one that called me. If anybody else, I don't know how I would have done it, but he was the manager. He called and he asked me, Guidry turned it down. And then. And I got mad at Gator later, but he goes. He recommended me. He goes, let Rigetti do it. I thought, crap. So, things changed. Talking about pressure, I had pressure on myself to be a great pitcher, obviously, from day one when I got there when they said I'm the next Guidry. So I learned to live with that. But when I became the closer, that was a different kind of – because, I mean, there's nothing worse than looking on the New York Post the next day and seeing Rags – Gags on the back. I thought, that's nice. but I had fun with it. I was a little bit, I wasn't crazy. A lot of it was an act, to be honest. I know Butch thought I was nuts, maybe, but you know what? It was my way of handling that whole zoo or whatever. And it was, I'm not saying it wasn't, and Butch understands, but I was worried, Sweeney, that the next year, the next new manager was going to have me go back. And I said, if you guys are sure about this, if you believe I'm a closer type, let's do this. But if not, I don't want to be going back and forth. And they fought over it every year, of course. But either way, I was glad. I got to wear big league uniform for a long time, and I'm happy.
Yeah, you wore one for 16 years, and Butch wore one for 13. And I mean, we're talking about, you know, the greatest day you guys were ever able to combine for. Did you? I did not know this until about 45 minutes ago, Dave. Someone just sent me this on Twitter. There is a letter that was sent from the desk of a very famous person. I'm going to read a couple of lines for it before I tell everybody who it was from. It starts, "Dear Dave, as a native son of California and a Yankee fan, I felt especially privileged to see your masterpiece no-hitter." This was somebody who was there in person. It ends with, "The Yankees are lucky to have you, and you are fortunate to be so young and so talented. I wish you the best in the good years ahead. Sincerely, Richard M. Nixon."
Yeah. He did. I got it sitting right here.
Do you really?
He came in a clubhouse. Every now and then he would come in. I guess he lived in Saddle River at that time occasionally, and he was a big what was cool about him, he would come in and talk ball with you, and he must have watched all the games. And I know he walked around the clubhouse and would shake hands with guys, and so that was pretty cool. I guess he was in George's box.
Exactly what the story I saw, and that's phenomenal.
Sweeney, can I ask Butch? Hey Butch,
yeah,
I got a question.
So, got it.
Hey, Sweeney, our bullpen catcher was Dom Scala, who was the Adelphi head coach for the last 15 years. But so Dom had a jewelry business called Scala Jewelry, him and his wife. And I asked him, I said, "Can you do something for Butch, me and Butch?" Because George was going to maybe do something for the team or whatever, because Dick Young got in the paper and said, "Rigetti deserves this or that," you know, so... Because I didn't have it in my contract, like you knew you're going to throw a no-hitter, right? So anyway, I said, "We got to do something." And so Dom made up these two rings, and they were a little bit gaudy. Dom had a little colorful side to them. But I've never worn the ring. I don't know if Butch has.
But no, it's in my safety deposit box. I've never worn it, but I
still
got
kidding.
It.
Yeah.
Yep. I've met Dom. Absolutely. That's phenomenal.
He's a character, yeah. I love him.
George got us all, the whole team, then what?
A watch.
Engraved in the back of the ring. I still have
that.
Wife and I were looking at it the other day. I need to get a battery in it. But
that was really nice of him. Now these
really
guys got so much money, they give every guy gets a Rolex that played in the game. It's wonderful, I said, "Christ, I got to, you know, like making a hole in one at the club, you got to buy 50,000 drinks, right, or whatever." But, you know, I'm figuring I got to buy something. So, you know,
and I appreciate that, Rags. I've got
about 1 minute left, and any one of you in 30 seconds, is there anything you want to say to each other about that magnificent day or anything else going on?
I'm glad I did it with somebody like Butch, to be honest. I like Butch. We were friends, and he had a great demeanor. I think the last time I remember him and Doyle Alexander were playing cards in a Kansas City locker room back there during the game. My friend, you know what? Always, you know what? A talented guy, great switch hitter. And, I miss you, Butch. I used to take it for granted because I'd run into you during the season somewhere in the minors of the big leagues.
Right.
And so I just want to say hi and hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I appreciated you too, Rags. Yeah, I just want to tell you and just say thank you for probably the biggest highlight of my career was that day in Yankee Stadium. And I was just so proud of you and everything and what you accomplished. And I wish we were closer together. We live across the country and everything. But
I know.
We'll run into each other again.
All right, pal.
Guys, I want to thank you so much for helping out with this. Butch, I've known you for several years, in the Yankee organization.
Yeah.
Always love talking to you. Dave, this is my first chance to talk to you, and I'm so glad you were able to find time to do this. This was fantastic. I can't thank you enough. Enjoy your 4th of July, and maybe we'll do it again sometime on another 4th of July down the road.
Thank you for having me and him on. It makes it very special.
Dave, thank you.
Sweeney, thank you.
All right. Take care, guys. That's Dave Rigetti and Butch Weiniger. On July 4th, 1983, a 94-degree day at Yankee Stadium. They combined for 132 pitches from one to the other. And when it was all over, Wade Boggs had struck out, and Dave Rigetti threw the first no-hitter by a Yankee since Don Larson's perfect game in the 56 World Series. A special day in Yankee history, and I want to thank those two guys for reliving it with us here.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. and great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.